when mom's not around. This becomes extremely layered. So know that one ace doesn't necessarily guarantee another, but they do impact one another. So we really, really have to think about how things that may seem small to us or may seem like adult situations that we don't have to explain to children. We really have to think about how these things may impact a child in the present, but will also impact them over the long run. So we know now what the aces are, but what does that mean when I say impact us over the long haul? There are literally physical changes that take place in the mind and in the brain development of a child who experiences trauma and chronic stress. One of those things is delays or disruptions in brain development. I know many of us have had experience where we see a child that's engaging in a behavior that is chronic, and we see a child that's engaging in a behavior that's detrimental to themselves or another, and we say to them, why don't you just stop? Just stop implies that this child has the cognitive ability to process what is going to happen if they make a certain decision. Believe it or not, brains impacted by trauma experience delays in development that make it so that process is interrupted, that it physically cannot take place. We also see social and emotional issues there. If I have been abused by someone that I trusted, that sense of security is now gone. So how hard is it going to be for me to start to cultivate relationships with other people, but even beneficial relationships like student-teacher relationships? Also, we see short and long-term mental and physical health problems that begin to result, and early death as well. So all of these things that we see here listed on the screen under mental and physical health concerns, like severe obesity. I know I've seen shows over the last couple of years that focus on people who have issues with emotional eating. And when they tell the stories about why they're emotional eating, it all tied back to some traumatic event that took place in their lives that went unaddressed, that they were never given the actual skills to help them work through that experience. So when we talk about ACEs are not just these isolated incidents that take place, but it's also the impact, the long-term effects of what happens as a result of a child having these experiences. So we talked about what ACEs are, but let's talk about what they're not. Just because a child has an ACE, it does not necessarily mean that they're tied to a specific demographic. So we want to completely debunk that. Children who have economic disparities are not more likely to experience ACEs than children who come from wealthier backgrounds. We saw that in the ACE study sample. All of the individuals who were a part of that study were from a very privileged background, and still the ACEs were pervasive. So we have to be mindful of that when we're thinking about who has been impacted by an ACE. Also, we need to be mindful that ACEs don't necessarily predict life outcomes. For example, my ACE score is a 9 out of 10. And a lot of the things that I've seen colleagues struggle with and some of my students struggle with, I personally haven't had those struggles. However, there are other struggles that I have had that I know people who I would feel experienced ACEs that were way more tragic than my own, and they seem to be fine. So we can't necessarily predict what we're going to see as a result of a student who or a child who's experienced an ACE. One thing we have to remember as well is that the statistical trends associated with ACEs and trauma and toxic stress, that the data is there. And we know that these are indicators of public health issues and larger systematic problems, but they can't necessarily predict a life outcome for an individual. Again, I am a 9, and I've had friends who have struggled profusely and they have ACE scores of 1 and 2. So we don't know exactly how an ACE is going to impact an individual. Our best line of defense is helping individuals develop skills to combat the impact of those ACEs. So we were talking about ACEs and trauma, but what is trauma? Let's put a definition to that term. Oftentimes when I ask what trauma is, individuals will say to me, oh, it's an event. Trauma is not an event. There can be a traumatic event that is experienced by an individual, but the trauma is our stress response to the event. This is what makes it so pervasive. An event can occur once, but that stress hormone can be triggered over and over and over and over again. This is what makes those traumatic events so impactful. So I want you to take a second, because I have people tell me all the time, well, I haven't had a traumatic event. I don't know what that would feel like for my child. So I'm going to throw you in a scenario. Let's say you're driving, just thinking about your getting long to-do list, because we all have them and they are long. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a truck runs a stop sign and comes literally inches from hitting you. Of course, you're going to slam on the brakes and skid off the road out of the way just to make sure that you avoid this collision. In that moment, what does your mind do? Are you still thinking about that to-do list? All these things I have left to do. I was on my way to work. I was on my way to the grocery store. I'm just going to carry on business as usual. What are your emotions around that experience? And what is your body doing that moment? And how easily can you just transition back, or can you just stop that feeling? We ask kids to do this all the time, because if a child has been assaulted or abused by an individual, and that individual lives in the household, and then all of a sudden that individual enters the space again, and the child kind of freezes up, tenses up physically, or begins to cry. And oftentimes we'll say, hey, stop that. Go on about your business. Do what you were supposed to be doing. I've given you a direction. For that child, it feels like that car almost making impact. They feel that physical rush of adrenaline or in their bodies. They feel all of those emotions, that fear, bubble up. And sometimes it's paralyzing and they don't have the words to explain what they're feeling. It could be a bully at school that's causing that same traumatic experience. And every time someone raises their voice or to hear someone yell, they feel that same surge of fear and paralyzing feeling in the body come over them again and again and again, because they're connecting it to that traumatic experience. So just like if we were in this particular situation, if we've just been run off the road, the expectation wouldn't be that we can just get right back on the road and be fine and dandy and go on about our day. We would need some time to regulate what we were feeling, some time to understand and calm our bodies and let us know, hey, you're not in any immediate danger anymore. Children need that same thing. And it's not going to be instantaneous for them either. And we have to begin to help them in that process. So when we're talking about what is being experienced in the body, this is what we call is your stress response system. And it's a beautiful thing. Everyone has one. And its sole purpose is to keep us safe. That's what it was designed to do. And it does it very well. So when we feel any kind of threat, our brain tells our bodies to respond in one of three ways. Either fight, because we believe that we have the strength to take down the disastrous thing that is coming to harm us, whether that's a physical takedown or a verbal takedown. That's why we'll see children sometimes when they feel heightened emotions start to verbally spar with us. It's them attempting to make the danger go away. They feel threatened and their stress response system is telling them, if I say this thing or do this thing, it'll stop it. Sometimes we see children respond with flight. These are your children who walk away from a conversation that they see as threatening, or a child who might go in their room, or a kid who hides under a bed. We also see freeze as a response. Sometimes a sense of terror or extreme emotion can come over a child and they literally just shut down. These are the children I would see sometimes in my classroom who you would ask them a question and they would just put their heads down and just stay there and not move in hopes that you would move along. Again, this system is designed to keep us safe, but if this system has been triggered over and over and over and over again, it can start to give off what we call some false positives. It can begin to be so sensitive that it perceives things as threats that really aren't threats. So someone yelling from another room for you, hey, I need you to go grab X, Y, and Z from the bathroom. That loud yelling or the sternness in a voice can be perceived by their stress response system as a threat and send them into either fight, flight, or freeze. So think about how you see fight, flight, or freeze responses in your own children. What are some things or some responses you see from them when they begin to engage in those behaviors? I've seen children hide underneath beds. I've seen children literally attempt to verbally spar with their parents. I've seen siblings go head to head, physically fighting. I've even seen children's parents say, I know you hear me talking to you. I know you hear me talking to you. And the child is just standing there, eyes closed, not moving, hoping that if they continue to do so, then the threat will go away. Take some time to really, really think about not only what the child is doing, but why might they be doing that? At what point in time did they learn that this response guaranteed them safety from the threat? Because this is a learned behavior. Think about how long it's been happening and communicate with your child. Hey, can you tell me why you do this? And reminding them that you're trying to learn how to best support them and help them to feel safe. One of the ways that we explain this idea of the stress response system and when parents should intervene to support their children is through this analogy called the wise owl and the barking dog. So I'm going to play just a short clip of this video about the wise owl and the barking dog. And this is also a great way to explain it to your children as well.
So I want to talk for a minute about how to teach the brain.
And I'm going to jump a little
because
bit.
Because you've had to be really strong to be a survivor, a thriver. So what happens is that the brain gets what I call emotionally hijacked. This downstairs brain comes up on top of this brain. It takes over, okay? So the downstairs brain's in control. And so you fight, you run, you freeze. The only things that work when you're down here are things that calm you down. So we call them self-regulation skills. And that happens from connection. Somebody talking to you, helping you breathe, helping you feel your body calm down. Once that happens, then the upstairs brain can calm back, and then you can solve problems. So that's how I try to explain to teenagers the downstairs brain and the upstairs brain, and what happens to them when they experience a threat. With young children, what I've found is they like animals. When I say young, probably 3 to 8 years old, sometimes teenagers like it too. And so what we call this is the downstairs brain, that threat center again, is what I call the barking dog. If you think about when any noise or threat makes, usually a dog will bark. So this is the barking dog, okay? A problem solver is often called the wise owl. So upstairs is the wise owl, downstairs is the barking dog, okay? When the dog barks, the owl flies away. And so when the dog's barking, the only things they can do are maybe practice blowing bubbles, maybe practice breathing deeply, things that help the dog start calming down. And that's where you build their self-care strategies. They practice lots of different things to help the dog stop barking. The first skill being recognizing when their dog barks. Once they learn how to calm the barking dog, then the owl flies back, and then they can come up with solutions. And again, they're trying to get this muscle stronger. The problem for most people who are intervening, if you're talking to a family, most parents are gonna naturally start with redirection and consequences for negative behavior. That's the first place they go. They're shaking fingers and telling somebody, stop that, you need to do this. That's an upstairs brain intervention, while most children who've experienced trauma are downstairs. So the term Siegel uses is you connect, then you redirect. The only thing that will calm a barking dog or the downstairs brain is helping that child calm down. And only then, once you teach the child to calm down, can you engage the part of the brain that solves problems and actually come up with solutions for better behavior choices. And that's why it's important to respond to the need, respond to the safety needs that get kicked up by threat, and not just react to the behavior that happens.
So I love the analogy of the wise owl and the barking dog. Sometimes it's hard to help our children understand these serious science terms around the brain, the hippocampus. Most kids, who, especially small children, are like, what is that? But when we talk about that wise owl and that barking dog, kids can connect with that. And I think it's a very important analogy for parents as well. Because one of the things that was brought up there that's extremely important is not only that we need to intervene to help children calm down, but a really important takeaway there is when we should intervene and how. And we're going to continue to build on those ideas as we continue to progress tonight. But I really, really, really want you guys to really hone in on the fact that children cannot do this alone. They need us to help them develop those self-regulation skills, but it is a process. So we have to help them learn to acknowledge when their barking dog is about to bark, help them calm down once it starts barking, and then begin to provide that redirection and support once they are calm.
So I want to talk for.
So how do we actually help calm the barking dog for ourselves and for our children? Because I don't know about you all, but when my daughter or one of my students starts to have that dog barking, 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 I am not in the happiest place myself. Because usually the behaviors that we see as a result of the trauma, that visible piece, can sometimes be triggering to us as parents. So how do we begin to deal with our own barking dog? Because we have to put on our mask first, then we can begin to help someone else. So what does that look like? And it takes a few different forms. One of those forms is connection. So our tone of voice, sometimes if we don't pay attention to it, can often continue to heighten a child who is triggered. So we need to find a way to speak calmly in order to help reinforce that idea that the child is in a safe space, that there's no threat. Also, our body posture. Our body language says a lot to children. So how can we position ourselves in a way that we are conveying safety and non-threat to the child? Also, our facial expressions. If you are like me, my face tells on me. I carry all my emotions in my face. So I have to be extremely mindful that even when I am addressing a difficult situation with a child, whether it be my own or a child that has been charged in my care, to be very mindful of what messages, what nonverbal signals my facial expression is sending to this child who I'm trying to help regulate their emotions. And then reminding the child I hear you. Because oftentimes that fight response has a direct connection to feeling unheard. So letting the child know, I hear you, I'm listening. Also, when you're talking about how to calm yourself or someone else so that you can be of support, deep breathing is amazing. I cannot tell you how many times I've had to reset my breath before addressing a situation, and it is so helpful. The naming of colors and sounds you see around you is a way of channeling negative energy into another space. So if I'm literally looking around the room, trying to count colors or listening to sounds around me, then my attention is off of the frustration that I'm feeling onto something else that is non-threatening. Also suggest things like heavy work. So pushing against walls or squeezing stress balls. It's a good way to help us transfer that energy into a more positive space. And those are things that we can do quickly to help ourselves to calm our own barking dog so that our own wise owl flies back so that we can help support children. Now, I know we've talked about all of this very heavy stuff, but believe it or not, there's some good news. The beautiful thing about the brain is that it's a muscle. And just like I can go to the gym and just build and build and build my muscles and change them, you can change your whole physique by lifting. So when you really think about the brain's a muscle too. And kids' brains are changing every day. So we can literally help them begin a mindset shift into a space of regulation. And it will begin with co-regulation because they will need our support in developing these skills. And then they will shift into a space of self-regulation. But the beautiful thing is that we can help stimulate that process and help them to rewire that stress response system. So maybe it's not so sensitive and it doesn't receive so many false alarms. But the only way we're going to make that work is by focusing on ourselves first. Because you cannot help anyone as a parent co-regulate if you are not in a great space yourself. I'm sure that you've heard the expression a million times that you cannot pour from an empty cup. And it is so, so, so true when we're talking about co-regulation. You cannot give what you don't have. So part of this process is going to require us as parents to make sure that we are checking in with ourselves, having that mindfulness moment, remembering that when a child is experiencing a peak traumatic response, that's not the time to intervene. So continue to strengthen our own resiliency muscles so that we can be of support. And here are some strategies that I suggest that are absolute great ways to do that. And I won't read them all to you, but there are a few that I love that work extremely well for me. I would suggest trying any of these because they're all research-based and they all work well. One of my absolute favorites is the voice-recorded brain dump. When I get extremely triggered by a situation or get extremely frustrated, my phone is already at no point ever more than a few inches away from me. So I'll literally turn on my voice recorder and I will say all the things, everything I want to say, every good word, every bad word, every thought, to get it out of my space and transfer that energy somewhere. I still got to say everything I felt like I needed to say. I still got to say it in the way I wanted to say it. But how many times could we damage relationships by speaking out of emotion? Or how many times have we said things to our children that damage them emotionally? But if we also don't want to keep that stuff bottled up because we have to take care of self. So taking those thoughts, those words, that emotion and transferring it to another space can work wonders. Initially, I would just eventually delete them once I had gotten past that point. Now, I actually go back and listen to some of them. And It's helpful in two ways for me. One, I think about the fact that I didn't emotionally damage or traumatically impact my 7-year-old by saying these things to her. Because oftentimes those things are nasty. Whether they're nasty in the way I delivered them or things I said, they're not kind. So I was able to take care of myself first by getting it out. But I was also able to take care of my child by making sure that these things weren't detrimental to her. It also caused me to have some time to reflect on the impact that my words, my emotions can have on other individuals. And it reminds me of how important it is to be mindful of what I say, when I say, how I say, but to also take care of me in that process. So even if I know some people just don't want to talk to a friend because they don't want to be perceived as the parent who can't parent. First, never, ever feel that way, because it's all trial and error for us all. None of these beautiful babies came with manuals. So we have to keep trying strategies until we find what works. I initially started out with drawing and writing for my daughter as a way to calm her. And as much as she loved to write and draw, when she is emotionally heightened, that does not work for her. But what does work for her is a combination of two of these things, taking a walk and deep breathing. And so we adopted a process in our home called the deep breath walk. So when I say something to my daughter and she comes back verbally abusive or using a tone that is not appropriate when talking to her parents, I would say something like, "Hey, I think you might want to take a deep breath walk." And she will go take a walk by herself in the house somewhere, take some deep breaths. And when she's ready, she'll come back and say, "Okay, Mom, I'm ready to talk now." Because we've given her space to be able to do that. And we also talk about how just because that is something that we allow her to do, it doesn't take away responsibility for the choice that was made. It just meant that her dog was barking and we needed to help her calm that barking dog. And then once her wise owl flies back, we can then begin to have that conversation with a phrase we often use in our household, which is, it's okay to be mad, but it's not okay to be mean. And we talk about meanness and how it impacts other people and appropriate ways to express our anger. So when we're talking about self-care, keep in mind that I know a lot of people talk about trips, which are awesome, massages, facials, long hot baths, all that's wonderful. But for a lot of us, that requires something that we have the least amount of, and that is time. But I kind of want to debunk that idea of what self-care looks like. Self-care, I kind of look at it as our lives exist as a circle. And oftentimes as parents, we spend a lot of time giving ourselves what's left at the end of the day, that outer edge of the circle. Self-care is about taking yourself and pushing you closer and closer and closer and closer to that middle, where you start with checking in with yourself every day. Even if it's something like reading affirmations in the morning to help you recenter, or taking some time to make yourself a breakfast that you enjoy. Doing things that are just for you has been proven to help us start our day in a better place and help us to be more mindful of when a dog is about to bark. And it helps us be more sensitive to notice those things so that we can keep our wise owl around. And I talk about it in terms of us shifting from mindful to being mindful. We have so many things going around in our heads. And I don't know about you, but when I'm overwhelmed with a lot of stuff, that's a frustrating space for me. So how can I become more mindful of my own emotions so that I can be that support to my child? So once we check in with us, how can we begin to build skills with our children who really, really need us to be in that good space to provide that support? So let's talk a little bit about co-regulation as we finish up. There are three keys to building resilience in children and supporting them. They are warm, responsive relationships, safe, structured environment, and skills in instruction and coaching. Remember, I talked to you at the beginning about building strength, strong relationships with our children. Those warm relationships are going to be key, because if our children don't feel safe, they're not going to open up to us. And even if we share the best skills and strategies with them through modeling, they're still not going to be receptive because they don't see us as a safe space. So we need to model for them that we're doing the exact same things. We're being mindful of when our dog is about to bark. And we're having conversations from that rational mind, that wise owl. That creates that warm space and inviting space for them to be open to with us. So one of the things that I noticed that works really, really well with young kids is child-led play. Kids like to be in charge. And even if it's just sneaking in a little bit of role play, hey, this doll is so angry and this one is trying to see what's wrong. What would be a good way to help her calm down if she's a little angry? I've seen children use these kinds of things to model all the time, and it's awesome. One of my favorite that we use in our household is morning routine connections. When our daughter gets up in the morning, one of the first things I say to her is, how'd you sleep? And she answers, and I ask her, is she feeling happy today? If she says yes, I encourage her to continue on with her day and that I feel happy as well, and I share how I'm feeling with her. But if she says that she's not feeling happy, we talk about it. And it doesn't have to slow the morning routine down. I have stood beside her and brushed my teeth while she's telling me why she's not feeling happy. And we talk about things that she can do. I let her know that feeling is justified, and we talk about what she can do to begin to shift into a more positive space. Also, we want to make sure they have a safe, structured environment. And children need that. One of the biggest things we can do for them is remain consistent. Children need that consistency, and they need encouragement. Kids need to know what the routines are, because that's how they continue to operate within those expectations, is by knowing what they are and knowing that they're going to be that way. So some ways that we can add structure: making sure that our rules are concrete and that making sure they're consistent. And we know different children in different age ranges may have different rules within a single household, but making sure that those rules are consistent for a child, an individual, is so extremely important in helping them begin to understand and process their world and to operate within the expectations they have been given. Another thing that I love to use in my classroom, as well as in my home, is peace corners. In my classroom, we used to call them safe spaces, but it's just a space that a child can go to that has things that bring them calm, centered feelings. My daughter has kinesthetic sand in hers. She loves that stuff. It is awesome. And anytime that she's feeling frustrated, she'll often ask to go play with it. I noticed for my middle school age students, music is killer when it comes to helping them reset. So in the space I had in my classroom, there were headphones over there, and the kids could plug up and listen to something to help them calm. Part of making a space like this successful is asking your child what keeps them calm, that communication piece, because then you don't have to rack your brain figuring out, because trust me, they will tell you. I know that I've had that experience in my classroom as well as in my own home. Children will tell you. And last but not least, skills and instruction and coaching. We cannot expect kids who've been impacted by trauma to do this by themselves. So we need to help them, because stress and trauma and COVID disrupts all of these things. Their learning and development, we talked about what it does in the brain. It also disrupts their behavior. Sometimes kids become anxious and defensive. They withdraw because they don't understand what's happening, and it's undermining their sense of safety. It also threatens sometimes the trust in relationships. So we have to make sure that we acknowledge this going into that process. And in teaching self-regulation, we have to help them regulate not only their behaviors, but their thoughts and feelings as well. It's a total package. And there are ways that we can help them do that. And some of them are things like self-talk. I know that one has been huge for me in work with middle school students and elementary school students, because somebody's not always there to encourage you, to help you rationalize what's happening, but you can talk yourself, as I've heard before, off a ledge, reminding yourself about what's currently going on in the present, because oftentimes the things that trigger children in their thoughts have to do with them being worried about things that haven't happened yet. What may happen? What is mom gonna say? What might happen if? So having them engage in that positive self-talk is awesome, because it reminds them to stay in the present. That hasn't happened yet. And sometimes having them and us verbally say that to ourselves is very regulating. So these are just some examples. And I'm also gonna share some at the end of the session as well, in the form of a document for you guys. Some strategies you can do at home. Some of these are reiterations of ones I've shared before, like the mindfulness apps, the breathing practices. And again, no one is going to say, hey, this one works for everybody. Give them a try. Communicate with your children and ask them, hey, what makes you feel better when you're not feeling so great? And you can begin to connect some of these strategies to some of their what they're communicating. And this piece is super important. Remember, the best time to intervene with a child who is frustrated or triggered is at that early stage. So when they first start to see, man, that dog is about to bark, great time to intervene, so that the wise owl doesn't fly away. But if a child is already in the midst of a fit of irritability, or they're frustrated, you got to calm them down first. And then once they're calm and that wise owl is back, then we can intervene. That is the co-regulation model. That is you and your child working together to help strengthen those self-regulation skills. So some top takeaways for tonight. I know I have talked a lot about trauma and how to help our children and ourselves work through trauma. Remember, rebuilding safety is key. When a child has experienced chronic stress or trauma, that's what they're experiencing. They are experiencing this lack of safety. How do we get them back into a space where they feel safe? Give yourself grace. This is not an overnight process. This is going to take trial and error. It is going to take some explosions. There are going to be some wise owls that fly away. Keep at the work, because you can do it. Take time to connect with your child every day. Don't wait until something happens to try and intervene. Though that morning time, those meetings, that connection is so important. Remind them each day that school, home, all these safe spaces. Remind them that they are so important to you that you would never send them into a place that's not safe. Establish routines and rituals at home that are predictable for them, because there's safety and predictability for children, no matter what age. And remember, ask teachers. Teachers are a great resource, guys. Oh, they're such a great resource. Ask teachers about what they are doing at the school level to help support social and emotional learning, because that's going to help build that consistency, because children spend so much of their day at school. That is a huge, huge one. And it will provide so much support and comfort for you as a parent as well. So making it linear for the children is wonderful. So I'm so excited that you all decided to come jump on with us tonight to talk a little bit about this heavy subject, but how we can really, really jump in here and be true advocates for our children and ourselves. And if you have any questions or would like any additional resources or need support in this area, I am so open to having those conversations. Feel free to reach out to me at my website for that support. or shoot me an email at whyweleap@gmail.com. I love, love, love talking to parents. I love, love, love providing support, because helping parents helps children, which helps our community at large. But thank you so much. At this time, if there are any questions, I would love, love, love to answer any that you have.